Radio City it is, and a very special edition of Radio City, our fourth anniversary. John Grayson and Rob Ross doing some talking about what's going on out there. And Rob, how are you?
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
Yeah, and it's been 4 years for us, and it's also the fourth anniversary of something very special that you were a part of just a little while ago. So what were you doing 4 years ago?
4 years ago, it will be tomorrow is the exact date, was the closing of the Maxwell's as we knew it in Hoboken. Of course, Maxwell's has since reopened under a different guise, but it was the end of the original golden era. And the night that Maxwell's closed, as silly as this may sound, the fulfillment of a teenage dream came true when I joined the bongos on stage for the last song that would be performed at Maxwell's, and it turned out to be Big Star's Thank You Friends. So that is a moment that will forever be in my heart and in my soul and on my mind at this point every year. And it was an incredibly powerful moment that even now when I think about it and I picture it, I do tend to get some chills. And if I go on about it, I probably will get choked up in a very good way. So, and that, of course, led me to my first appearance on your old program. Can we say it by name?
Yeah, oh, sure, yeah, on Overnight America, yeah.
On Overnight America with John Grayson, because it was our fearless leader, El Jefe, who had emailed me to say, hey, you know, we do this pop dose segment on a show called Overnight America with John Grayson, and, you know, he read your story about what happened at Maxwell's, and he would like to have you on. And I thought, okay, cool. I'd never done anything like it, and who knew that it would lead us to this, our glory, our notoriety, and our fame precedes us now.
Exactly, yeah, and you know, and who knew we would get along this well for 4 years? So I don't do things I like for that long usually, but in this case, no, it's been great, and we've got a lot to talk about. And in fact, that Big Star DNA goes right through one of the first songs we're going to talk about. And Chris Corson is an interesting cat in a number of different ways, but even more interesting is what he just did that's a Popdos exclusive this week. Tell us about the new single.
The new single, which of course he released under the moniker of Nezrock, which is Corzin as an anagram,
yep,
is a cover version of a song by Van Doren, Andy Please. And it was a song written by Van and Jody Stevens, although their version was never released. It was later released by Van on his second album, Idiot Optimism, which didn't come out for a very long time after it was recorded. The nice thing about this particular version is that Mr. Duran is on the track singing backup vocals, along with Mr. Corzin's usual cast of characters, which features Dennis Dykin of the Smithereens, et cetera, et cetera. All in all, it's just another fantastic piece of pop, even though it's, of course, it's close to my heart because it's a Van Doren track. Chris Corzin is just so good at doing this. He's one of those graduates of the Big Star Raspberries Badfinger School of how to write classic hooky pop without falling into the trap of predictability.
Yeah. And this one, again, it just I've used this before, but it's like a warm bath. I mean, this song just, it's so comfortable to listen to, and it's got, like you said, those really nice poppy hooks to it. But the production on this one, I think, is really special because it just, we're going to talk some more about this because the other song that we're going to talk about this week also has this capacity in it. It reminds you of what was on the radio, what was on AM pop radio in the last of its heydays before FM took over.
Well, you know, it's funny having you and I grew up at the same time of AM radio. And, you know, certainly I was inundated, especially in the car, naturally, by the last two standing truly great top 40, if you will, stations in the New York market, which were at that point WNBC and WABC. Mm-hmm. So in those days, you would have great sounding things from the likes of Elton John, Queen.
Yep.
The Raspberries were on the charts, certainly. But then you had the one-hit wonder singles that still sounded great, like The Last Song by The Edward Bear, which is still one of my favorite songs of all time, let alone the 70s.
Yep.
God, as much as it pains me to say it, even Afternoon Delight sounded good.
Starland Vocal Band.
God, when I heard Waterloo for the first time, I was nearly knocked right out of my chair because it just came at you
Yeah.
like a windstorm. It just blew you away. So you had good production that was always because records at that point were still being made for AM radio. So you had to have a sound that would really captivate.
Yeah, right. And that's why you had all these different influences that were played on the same radio station. I mean, you were listening to WNBC, WABC. I was on the other end of New York State listening to the legendary WKBW. And for the longest time, between KB and WJW, which was Alan Freed's station in Cleveland, that was what the Northern Midwest had to listen to. And then later on, WLS out of Chicago, before long before they went talk. They were doing a lot of the pop music too that would carry at 50,000 watts late at night around half the country and most of Canada. So you had a sound good in mono on AM. And you're right. I mean, you mentioned Waterloo. My wife and I, on Friday night just this past, we went to see that musical, Mamma Mia, the one that they made out of all of the ABBA stuff. And you know what? Fuck, ABBA was a good band. That's really all there is to it. They sounded good, and in the context of the time, that music was great.
And that's why it's still timeless. That's why people still listen to it.
Yep.
That's why still people will always get a chill of joy and nostalgia when they hear those songs. And I'll simply say this, two things, SOS and Knowing Me, Knowing You. I don't care what anybody says. Forget Dancing Queen, forget Take a Chance, forget Fernando, forget those other songs.
Right.
Those two songs and Waterloo, that's the trifecta right there. You knew those guys, Benny and Bjorn, could write because
Yes.
of the way those songs are structured, especially Knowing Me, Knowing You. There's something about it that has that classical nature underneath it all. And those vocals are so spot on.
Yep. Well, and it's funny too, because not only is there Mamma Mia out there now, and I think they're in their last tour ever around the country. So, well, ever, I mean, they're going to do a revival, I'm sure, 20 years down the road. But for this particular period of its history, and it's been out there for like 15 years now, this is it for Mamma Mia. But the other thing, and before I have to turn in my guy card completely, is their music was also featured in a movie called Muriel's Wedding. And that movie is hilarious. Toni Collette, long before she was famous in The Sixth Sense and thereafter, she was very young when she did this movie. And you know what? It's really fun. And Rachel Griffiths looks just gorgeous in it too. It also centers around the music of ABBA. So yeah, there had to be something there.
Yeah, it's funny. That was the movie where I first saw Toni Collette, and I thought, God, she's adorable. And then she was in that god-awful film, The Velvet Goldmine. And I thought, man, she is just smoking hot.
Yeah.
She was really good in that one. The whole glam era thing really worked for her really well. That kind of costuming was terrific. But God, what an awful movie. Oh, wait a minute. Michael Stipe had something to do with it. And it's a Todd Haynes film. No surprise there. It's going to suck.
Yes, but before we leave music entirely, there is another one that the Thin Cherries. I know we've talked about them before, but it's been a little while, and they've got their first full-length studio album, self-titled, out as of this week as well. And this, as I said, this is another piece of music that you've got linked on the page with the review, that the song Dorian Gray off of this album. Boy, I mean, when you hear the slapback on both the lead vocal and the harmony vocal, and it just, it takes you back to right 1969, 1970 AM pop radio. It's a great, great song.
Yeah, well, here's the interesting thing. This is yet again another band from Chicago.
Yep.
How many times have we said this over the 4 year span? There's something in the water of Chicago that
Yeah.
it's producing such an incredible amount at such a rapid rate of talented singers, bands, musicians. And they're all so different too. I don't think any two of them really are comparable to this point, or at least to the best of my memory, with all that we've covered.
Yep.
And with this band in particular, it's an interesting mix and contradiction of sounds because They do have that late 60s, early 70s feel. They definitely have some kind of influence, be it direct or roundabout, from the likes of, well, certainly I kept hearing Mark Bolan's voice.
Yeah. You know?
Definitely kept hearing, you know, a Tony Visconti, Mark Bolan tag team production. But the thing is, overall, and this may be a stretch, to me, the overall sound, the density of sound, is kind of like the band Lush.
Yep.
Without the noise factor of Lush. But if you think more, let's really go back to the early 80s. And, you know, we've talked about the sound that the Chameleons has had.
Mm-hmm.
But I will pinpoint two other bands that came from that kind of, I wouldn't call it a genre, but I would definitely say it was a definitive oral texture that certain bands went after. And the two bands I'm thinking of specifically are Adrian Borland, God rest his soul, his old band, The Sound, and the Comsat Angels.
Yeah.
You know, it has that kind of density and that kind of, these were bands that used harmonics a lot, incorporated into the melody, not as the framework of the structure, but in the melodies, and it worked every time. And the Thin Cherries had that kind of feel. It's like they took a little bit from all the best elements of that early 80s reverb delayed feel and the kind of production qualities that somebody like Tony Visconti had spearheaded with Bolan and Bowie.
And Bowie, sure.
You know, and you know, some of the production of the late 60s, that kind of Gloom Johns feel to it as well. Importantly, the songs do have a kind of wide range of covering. There's a little bit of psychedelia. There's one particular song that I liked, especially called Star Lounge, which to me sounded like the Rain Parade. And you know, I could just go off for about an hour on that alone because of right. How much I love the Rain Parade. But there you go. It's the case of they took a lot of influences and made it work in a coherent, singular attempt. Because there are bands that will do that. They'll take a bit of everything from the smorgasbord, and it'll just come out ham-handed because it didn't work. You know, a novel concept and a noble attempt, but it didn't work. It worked here.
Yeah.
And that's the key thing. It worked. So
right.
With a debut album, there's always the hope that, okay, let's see what they produce on another album, and let's hope that it goes to another record that they can sustain.
Well, yeah, and I think the real talent in what you were talking about is that you can take all of those influences, and I think what is going on right now with The Sins and their new release has a lot of the same quality to it. You take all of those influences from the late 60s, from the mid 80s, from, you know, whatever it is, from some of the stuff that's out now or has been over the last 10 years, and you're able to make something that pays maybe not an homage, but at least acknowledges that music preceded you. But what you're producing doesn't sound antique-y. It doesn't sound old. It doesn't sound like you're a tribute band to something that came before.
Well, there are a lot of bands that don't seem to understand that concept, though. And in fact, will release records that sound like something you've already heard. And then along with that misstep comes the added yoke of arrogance that they will inevitably carry with them in defense of their misstep.
Right.
You know, I don't want to hear a band that deliberately went out of its way to sound like REM circa Murmur. I have that album. I don't want to hear your take on it.
Yep.
You know, I might appreciate your homage to it, but there's only one REM and one Murmur. Now, you're talking about The Sins. The thing is that we have listened to and watched them grow over the 4 years that you and I have been doing this. So too they have grown, and they have grown exponentially. And I say that with a lot of, I hope it doesn't sound too chauvinistic, but pride, because I've watched the progression of this band very closely. And their sound has improved markedly. And we're talking about At first, it was indeed in steps, which any smart and astute band will do.
Yep.
Then it just, as the confidence grew and the quality of the songwriting grew, and let me go back to the word confidence, because that is a key component here. The confidence in them as studio performers, because live, they're a completely different entity. Live on stage, they are in their element. There's no question of comfort. And Cindy Dawson, as a performer, knows exactly how to do it, where to do it, when to do it, the way to do it, live. The studio is a very daunting and very intimidating kind of place for anyone. I mean, certainly the first time I was in a recording studio, I had nerves.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's almost impossible to not feel nervous. And, you know, she has become so much more incredibly comfortable in a studio setting with the headphones on in front of the microphone. And I think nowhere better reflected. Let's go back 2 years at this point to the single Right to Your Grave. Because that was the first, and I'm saying this in a very positive way, warning shot that, okay, they're going forward in major steps.
Yep.
The sound of that track really took them to a new level. But it was devil in the details that, for me, if they never did anything again, they cemented their, quote, legacy in my book and in my heart with that track, because of everything that went into that song. It's like they pulled all the best elements together of how to make your definitive pop classic.
Right.
You know, because let's also go back to the basics. They were, for all intents and purposes, almost your standardized New York area neo-punk slash garage type of band at the outset. They've developed and grown and matured and blossomed into something far stronger and far more special, because they've got it. They've got it not because of by nature, because they worked at it. And if you work at it, you're going to reach it. They've taken notes and they've paid attention and they've refined their own sense of writing. And like I said, most importantly, the confidence is studio performers.
Yeah. Well, and we just got off the phone with him a little while ago to promote the new album. And it's that song that you mentioned, Devil in the Details, talked a little bit with Henry Size about writing that one. And it's clear when you listen to it that, yeah, by listening to that song, you know there was a The Birds, you know there was an REM, you know there was a Gin Blossoms. But you don't get the feeling, oh, they're trying to cop them. It's not that. It's not like we were talking about with Joe Scarborough and his band trying to be Elvis Costello. It isn't that. It's their own thing.
Right. I mean, there's always going to, if you have a 12-string Rickenbacker, obviously there's going to be a certain sound. I mean, there's no way around that. It doesn't matter who you are. You know, when I pick up my 12-string Rick, you know, my first thoughts immediately always go to a couple of, you know, the preliminary elements, the Birds, the Bo Brummels, and the Beatles, you know, on that first go around. But then 12-string Rickenbacker is also equal to me, REM, naturally.
Right.
Consider the fact that Pete Buck almost never, ever used one. But still, you get that certain chiminess that only a 12-string Rick can give you.
Yeah.
The point being is that it has a certain sound. And if you want a song to sound a certain way, then by all means, you use that instrument. Look, you're not going to be playing a Mandocaster if you want to approximate what you hear in your head as a balalaika. You pick up the balalaika and you play the damn thing.
Right. Right. And if you can't, you figure out how. But yeah, that's, you know, again, that's the skill of an artist. That's the skill of a musician. So great music all around. I mean, coming from all directions this week. So good news and all the more reason to check out elsewhere on Popdose and just look around for some of that. But we got a whole lot more going on outside of that as well, because I know, you know, you've been following this baseball season, tripping and dribs and drabs as it has been, and so have I. So now, as we approach the trade deadline, what are your thoughts? What are you looking at?
Well, with the fact that the Mets traded Lucas Duda on Thursday night, I could not have been happier, because I have never liked him. From the time that he joined the team, he's always had this look on his face of couldn't care less. Even if he hit a home run, it was couldn't care less.
Yep.
He never played with any kind of energy or spirit. And I'm sorry, last year he was a non-entity because he was out for most of the year with a back injury. You know, all of this hand-wringing by certain my fellow Met fans, come on. Last week it was a case of trade him, remember his throw in the World Series. Yeah, exactly why. Why has he still been here? Mm-hmm. You know, he's a guy that had to go. Now, they picked up a relief pitcher for nothing from the Marlins. I don't know what the motivation is behind that, if they're planning on making moves out of the bullpen, because tomorrow at 3 o'clock is indeed the deadline. But at this case, I've resigned myself to knowing that the Mets are sellers. The season's over for them because they just can't get a break as far as the injury bug. It keeps happening. It's plaguing them, and it's really not going away. I mean, for God's sakes, their young infield outfielder, TJ Rivera, now has a torn elbow muscle, which may mean he could need, if the injections don't work, Tommy John surgery. When was the last time you heard of a position player?
Yeah.
Tommy John surgery.
Right.
I mean, this is the kind of thing the Mets have endured from the beginning of the season. So I can look at this one as a write-off. It's just circumstance beyond anybody's control. Having said that, I'm watching other teams make deals that I'm not so sure as to why they're doing some of them. The only team that I can say right now that has been doing things to shore themselves up a little further because they don't need that much enhancement are the Nationals. But at the same time, you and I both know the Nationals aren't going anywhere beyond the first game of the playoffs because they'll choke again like they always do.
Right.
It's a fact. People are kind of measuring what are they going to do. And there was talk about them doing a deal with the Mets. And, you know, look, we will know better tomorrow, or at least over the span of this afternoon into tomorrow. But it is going to heat up, and it's going to heat up hard and heavy. How many bodies will be traveling to and fro across the country by tomorrow afternoon?
Well, yeah, and you mentioned the Nationals. The Cardinals here in town, that's one of the teams that they're also rumored to be. I mean, they're looking at Tommy Pham. They're looking at a number of different people. And the other hot rumor with the Cardinals right now is that Lance Lynn is on the block and may, in fact, end up in Houston. And I think that what happens with those two players specifically is going to give an indication as to not only what the Cardinals want out of the rest of the season, which, God, who knows, but what they want out of the next couple of years, what they want their identity to be. Because getting rid of a guy like Lance Lynn would give the impression that they're less interested in pitching than they are in just trying to build up more bats. Equally so with Tommy Pham. If fielding and you know, putting hits on the board is not that big of a deal to you, then do you keep a guy like Lance Lynn around, even though he may be getting toward the over-the-hump portion of his career, and just try to build up your bullpen more?
Well, you brought up a good point. Here's something else. You know, with the Mets, all of the names that have been mentioned in trade rumors from the get-go, they're all free agents at the end of the season, and all of them are 30 and above. That's number one. Duda is a free agent at the end of this year, and I don't care.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to see him be re-signed to begin with. Curtis Granderson has been a fantastic player, by and large, for the Mets on every level, not just on the field, but especially off the field. He's a great guy. And, you know, talk about a solid citizen within the team's framework and being a leader. You hate to see somebody like him go, especially because he's in the twilight of his career. I would think it would be, dare I say it, as much as it pains me, I think it would be a service and a kindness if they could do a deal with the Yankees, where they got him from when he became a free agent, just so he wouldn't have to leave New York, you know?
Right.
Because he did a great job when he was with the Yankees, hence the reason why the Mets signed him. You know, somebody like Jay Bruce, I really think the Mets should re-sign. You don't trade him and you re-sign him. He only just turned 30. He hit his 27th home run yesterday, for God's sakes.
I mean,
he's having a career year, you know, after getting – being a little shaky when he got traded from Cincinnati to the Mets last year. People were saying, oh, get rid of him. Over the winter, he moved his entire family and his life to New York and immediately made himself comfortable in New York and with the team. And it has shown from spring training onwards that he definitely should be here. Cespedes has shown us nothing this year after signing the four-year deal.
Right.
This becomes the question of, is this the guy that three teams previously got rid of after only one season, you know? And the other names that are on the trading block, like Addison Reed, who's a relief pitcher, and Asdrubal Cabrera, the shortstop slash second baseman slash third baseman, especially after his controversial comments about wanting to be traded if they were going to move him to second base. He's 34. He's a free agent. Reed is a free agent. The guy that they just got from the Marlins, they can control for one more year. So that may be kind of the, no pun intended, trade-off. You bring in someone you can control and then ship out Reed so you can bring back bodies. The thing that the Mets need to do is replenish the young pitchers down in the farm system and maybe get a decent bat. I'm not asking for a heavy hitter, a decent bat.
Yeah. Well, and you know, there's a couple of other things that have been going on in sports, because you look at football, and one of the big stories, I mean, here we are, it's just now getting out of July and into August, and already there's stuff going on with football. The Kansas City Chiefs made news this week because they moved Michael Vick from a sort of an internship position into a hired assistant coaching position. And so it looks like Michael Vick's going to be on the sidelines with the Kansas City Chiefs this year. And still, there's, I think, any time the camera lands on Michael Vick, there's still going to be that leftover piss off from a lot of us because of what he did that sent him to prison. And there was a lot of controversy about bringing him back into the league as a player. But I think even now on the coaching sidelines, there's still that idea that fame is something that you should lose, even if you can still get a job after going to prison. If you do something like that, something so heartless, and turn yourself into such a monstrous human being, that your part of your rehab from that is you give up any fame. And it's not fair. There's no way to quantify it, but I think that's what really pisses us off about it.
Well, you have to look at it from my perspective, as an animal lover and then as a Jets fan. The fact that the Jets actually had the audacity to bring that piece of shit back into professional football.
Yeah.
Don't you dare. Don't you dare come and say to me he's been rehabbed. And no. He's got no soul. Anyone who allows, let alone indulges in any kind of animal torture, first of all, that says to me right away, sociopath.
Yep.
Now, if you can do that to an animal, you can do it to a human being, and there's no way around it. Second of all, he deserved absolutely nothing for the league. That's what I don't understand. This is my biggest problem with any kind of fame-induced reintegration after doing something heinous.
Mm-hmm.
It's selective amnesia at work.
Right, right. Because we all have to look at it. Yeah.
You know what I likened it to? If Ray Caruth got out of prison and suddenly was allowed to play football again.
Yeah. Right.
And I'm telling you right now, that's going to happen. Someone will commit a murder and will be allowed to look. OJ is getting his pension from the NFL.
Oh, OJ's getting his pension from the NFL, but don't forget, I mean, there was also, what the hell was his name? Defensive lineman for the Rams who ran over and killed somebody in a drunken driving wreck and was on the field that season. Leonard Little.
Or for that matter, Ray Lewis.
Yeah, right.
I don't care that you were, quote, proven innocent. You were in the bar. You were part of that.
You
that
were involved.
Coach. Right. I don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
Criminals are criminals are criminals. I hate the fact that when it comes to sports, especially the NFL with their incredible galling righteousness, you know, I wind up getting so worked up into a froth whenever it comes to the bullshit that's always – and it's always fomented by the NFL more than any other you know, professional sports league.
Well, they certainly have a longer rap sheet, it seems, than just about any other sports league. So, and they're the ones who will sit there and try and justify it over and over again. But I want to go back to something you said about animal torture and what that all means. Because for the last couple of weeks, I've been pushing everybody to start watching the Jim Jeffries show. Holy shit, did he knock it out of the park this week. I don't know if you saw it, but he was talking about Donald Trump's kids. And he started off with, this is why I hate rich people, and then went into the whole trophy hunting idea. Whether it was that dentist from Minnesota, that asshole who went over and shot the lion, or whether it's Trump's idiot kids, Beavis and Butthead, or, you know, Uday and Kusei, or whatever the hell their names are. And, you know, going out and you know, shooting an elephant or shooting a jaguar or something like that just because you can pay money to go do it. And to paraphrase, I would advise everybody, by the way, to go to Comedy Central's site and watch this bit because it's on there. It's on the site. You can watch it. But he effectively said, if this was a poor guy who did the same thing within his means, we would tear him apart. If some poor guy paid a buddy of his $5 to go lure a house cat into his backyard so he could throw a dart at it and then shoot it and mount its head on his wall, we would put him in fucking prison.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because, and you and I did talk about this on a show not too long ago, but
yep.
I heard about this horrific case of a hotel clerk or hotel worker in Florida who took a bow and arrow and shot in the head and killed the cat that would kind of patrol the grounds. And he was a known, named, beloved cat.
Right.
The hotel covered this up as well by trying to erase the security tapes. When I tell you the pouring of outrage, not to mention that there are a couple of real sick fucks who have to just throw in their 2 cents about, you know, oh, it was just a cat, but, you know, that's exactly the kind of thing. This guy is going to jail.
Yeah.
He's going to go to jail for a long time. Or that piece of shit veterinarian, that heartless harlot who I don't even know what the outcome of her getting her license back or not was this week. The one who shot with a bow and arrow a cat.
Yeah, right.
You know? It's this kind of shit that it's really the lower tiered version of this whole big game hunting thing. Now, let's just look at it for what it is. You know, a couple of pussies like the Trump boys have to pay, or that fucking doctor from Minnesota have to pay to go to basically an enclosed space so they can play heap big game hunter.
Right.
Where the animals are easy targets. Let's see you go out in the brush and actually try to do this. You bunch of pussies.
Right.
You can't do it. You won't do it because you're afraid. You would shit your pants if you had to go out there because you know that while you're out there, a snake might sneak up behind you and bite you.
Yeah, and that's why, I mean, they have the gall to refer to it as sport hunting. Bullshit. I mean, even the New England Patriots get beat sometimes. When was the last time the Lion won? Yeah.
There was an incident recently. There was. Actually, no. It was an elephant who had been shot, but the elephant wound up killing the one who shot him.
Good. Good for him.
There was some justice involved. Or, you know what? Bullfighting, which is as heinous as anything else.
Right.
It's such a majestic spectacle. No, it's not. It's fucking torture is what it is. So when I heard about that fucking toreador that got speared, good.
Right. Well,
sorry, what happened to the bull right afterwards. Glad he got one in before.
Exactly. Yeah, because you know that no matter what else happens, the bull is eventually going to lose. But it's funny that brings us again right back to what's going on in the White House now, and what a just flipped upside down through the looking glass kind of world we're living in. So not only does Sean Spicer leave, and they bring in Nathan Detroit to be the new press secretary, but. On
sit
top
down,
of that,
sit down, sit down. You're rocking the boat.
Exactly. But on top of that, he goes off on this rant where he says, you know, I'm not Steve Bannon. I'm not trying to suck my own cock. That is a direct quote, by the way, from the White House press secretary. And he does that. If you had done that in service of your employer, if I had done that representing my radio station, we would have been fired in a heartbeat. But what happens? No, they fire the guy that he was calling, you know, whatever it was, a gutless pussy or something. Whatever it was he referred to Ryan's Priebus. Said he was a paranoid fucking schizophrenic. That's what he said. And so they fire Priebus and they leave Scaramouche, will you do the Fandango, you know, in his job. How does this happen?
I guess it has come to pass that in the Trump administration, anything goes.
Yeah.
That's really the only way to look at it. And I'm not playing it off because at this particular moment, I am fazed by nothing. I look at that gobble-gullet 10 miles of bad road that Sarah Huckabee Sanders bitch and think, wow. I'm not prone to violence against women, but I look at her the same way I look at Ted Cruz and Paul Ryan. I just want to punch her right in the fucking face.
Yeah, and it's you know, you cannot lie to me and pretend that I'm a dipshit that often and have me not get a little pissed off over it.
don't piss on my head and tell me it's raining.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You look at somebody like Scaramucci, whose wife announced yesterday she's divorcing him, and good for her.
Right, and she's 9 months pregnant, by the way.
What I find so myself incensed by, and I'm not trying to hold myself up to a higher moral standard by any stretch of the imagination, but again, it goes back to what you and I have talked about ad infinitum for years, and that is when you hold a position of authority in the office of the President of the United States, the very least you can do is conduct yourself with some sense of propriety. And this is just taking lowest common denominator to a new lower level.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy, I'm sorry, but he comes off as the archetypal, just filthy dago from Queens that everybody hates the stereotypes of. But that's exactly what he acts like. And people should be beyond outraged. And I don't care what your political stripes are.
Right.
You should be angry if you're a Republican, because this should not be representing you.
Well, yeah, and I think what we saw during the campaign is that Donald Trump found out that you can indeed win, provided you have a weak-ass candidate, which he did in opposition to him, but you can win the presidency by being an asshole bully. So what did he do? Well, he looked around and said, okay, well, I guess I better fill the White House full of other asshole bullies just like me so they can defend me, and that's what Scaramucci is. All the shit that he slung during the campaign towards Donald Trump because he was working for somebody else, they're playing it all back now, and it's the same shit. Only now he's saying it about everybody who isn't Donald Trump, and it's like, oh, come on, just stop it. It's so obvious that you have no compunction at all about lying through your teeth. How can you stand behind that podium with the great seal of the President of the United States on it, you bastard?
I still, you and I have talked about it. What the hell is Trump's endgame?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because he certainly doesn't have any plans for anything, any answers for anything, and certainly no culpability for anything either.
Well,
and now, before you and I started, the news coming out of Russia that 733 American diplomats are being told you have to leave the country now.
Right. Now what? Well, yeah, and we're starting a trade war over aluminum and steel that's going to make all of the alcohol prices go up, and it's all insane because he doesn't understand the repercussions for anything that he does, and here's an example of that. My mom, every couple of months, advises the President of the United States of America. She's been doing this now for 15 years. She was appointed by George W. Bush. She served him for 2 terms, Obama for 2 terms, and now she's wondering what she's going to do. But she has a report prepared that's supposed to go through the Department of Homeland Security Secretary directly to the President of the United States. And, like I said, she does this every so often. It's just part of what her appointment was all about. But you look at, and this is, by the way, coming completely from me and not from her. These are my thoughts alone on this. But you look at what she's dealing with, and this is where the rubber meets the road. So you have the private sector advising the President on a matter of policy, a vital matter of policy on homeland defense. But he just took the Homeland Security Secretary and made him his chief of staff because he fired Reince Priebus over all of this other swirling bullshit that's going on. So now this report has to go to who knows who, and then to the president. And given the fact that this is the same president who put Rick Perry in charge of the Department of Energy, Betsy DeVos in charge of education, and what's his name, Dr. Ben Carson in charge of HUD. Who knows who he's going to make the next Department of Homeland Security secretary? Could be Steve fucking Bannon for all we know. And can you imagine handing that kind of information to somebody like him?
There's only one other person I can think of, and he's dead, and that would be Major Frank Burns.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, that's what's really going on. So it's not so much about all of this day-to-day distracting shit that CNN and MSNBC and Fox all get, shiny-thinged by. It's about what's really going on in the process of government. And what's really going on in the process of government is not bloody much, and we're all going to pay for that.
Well, here's the thing. As far as CNN, Fox, MSNBC, and everybody else, all they're doing right now is giving themselves, media erections because they have a new story they can sink their teeth into.
Right.
As minute as the story might really be, they will make the mountain out of the molehill, just like everybody else tends to do about things. I mean, look, there's, you know, this week was the week that Trump decided to tweet out his I don't know if you want to call it policy or opinion or whatever it is on transgender, and I really hate that phrase.
Yeah.
Military personnel. If you look at the question at hand as to whether or not, quote unquote, trans people should serve in the military, it's a question of should the American people, should society in general be held responsible for paying the medical bills that this kind of process costs if you're in the service of the country? That's a problem right there because it's costly. You know, I don't want us to have to pay for anybody's personal thing. That's not right. That's, you know, that is your choice to make that changeover. Now, if you're somebody who already has gone through your changes and you want to serve, by all means, God bless you for serving. I don't care who you are. But to go through the change while you're in the military, that's not – that is something that is questionable. That'd be like saying, you know, yeah, I'm a diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic – and I have a police record, but I want to serve in the military. You know, you can't do that.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I look at it a different way because everybody's process is different and everybody's identity is different. And you don't know when somebody's going to get to that point or if somebody's going to get to that point. There's a lot of trans people who never make any kind of surgical transition. So when, again, this is part of the irresponsibility of Donald Trump, when in the middle of all of the other shit that's going on with no impetus whatsoever, when he just tweets this shit out at 5 o'clock in the morning, there's no thought behind it. There's no rational policy behind it. There's no anything. And it leaves 15,000 currently serving service members, some of whom are serving in places like Afghanistan, in the lurch. They don't know if they're going to have a job. They don't know if they're going to be drummed out of the military. They don't know what their future is now because, you know, all of the things that he said about it in the tweet, oh, after consulting with my generals, bullshit. All of your generals went, what the fuck's he talking about? We don't know anything about this.
The thing, I am fairly certain because I don't think, you know, you have to go through a physical when you're going into the military. And I don't think for a moment any of these people who are in the military right now who are, quote, trans people, they've already been going through the change. So they're already there, you know?
Right.
Because I don't think anybody's ever allowed them to just, you know, well, okay, you're going to have to take steroids while you're in the battlefield or that kind of thing, you know, not steroids, hormones.
Hormones, right.
When they're in the battlefield, you know, they're, you have to go through a psychological process, you know, and psychiatric treatment as well as the medical treatment of this. So it's not something that, you know, can be just flippantly put aside by the army or, you know, by the people themselves who are going through this, you know.
I don't mind them asking the questions. My thing is, if you're willing to put on that uniform and pick up a gun for this country, fuck it, I'll pay for your surgery.
Yes and no, and I say that because it's like going to the doctor or going to the hospital or going to the insurance company and saying, look, I'm fat because I've been fat, not because it's a family thing. I'm a fat slob, and I want to have surgery finally. I don't think we should be tagged for paying the bills for somebody who's allowed themselves to get in that. You know, it's a case by case basis.
Do you mean me? No, I'm just kidding.
Because I haven't fought Battle of the Bulge my whole life.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah. It's but you know that's the thing.
Point, you know, I would put a fucking gun in my mouth instead.
Right, but you know, this conversation that we're having right now is emblematic of exactly the problem that we're facing because there are serious, deep questions to be asked about all of these issues, and the guy asking them is a fucking dolt.
Well, that's exactly right. But notice, we're having a conversation
right,
about it.
Right.
We're actually tabling it and talking about it.
Yep.
And the fact that it's a controversial thing, but I have to admit, you know, it's because it's become the cause celeb lately that, again, like so many of the flavor of the month topics are, why it's suddenly such a big thing with such a tiny portion of people, because this is not a majority of people.
Right.
I'm sorry to disappoint anyone, but, you know, the trans community is not that big. When I see these parents out there with their, you know, protect trans kids or support – first of all, when I was 8 or my friends were 8 or if my kids were 8 – No one's talking about sexuality. I'm sorry. Not in this lifetime. This is insanity now. And, you know, you throw these kids then out there like lambs to the slaughter. You know, if I had a son who wanted to wear a dress and play with dolls, I'd worry a little. I don't – like anybody else would because, you know, okay. And then if time went by and he got over it, he got over it. You know, it wasn't because I beat God into him or anything like that.
Right.
It's a case of – it was a phase like any other – look, I went through my phase of playing soldier all the time too. It doesn't mean that I picked up a fucking gun.
Right. You know? Well, yeah, and all this week, all I've had in my head is the old Free to Be You and Me musical from the early 70s with William Wants a Doll. So, you know.
I'm going to vomit now because all I can think of is Rosie Grier. He just threw me right into the deep end of that. Man.
Yeah, it could have been worse. He could have had Ray Milland on his back.
Oh, now come on. If you're going to go in that direction, I still maintain the one with Bruce Dern was so much better.
Yeah, yeah. I will go there with you, no
the
doubt
thing
about
with
it.
Two heads? Oh, come on. That's far and away better. Anyway, thank you, folks. You love the non sequiturs. We know it. You're getting wet from it. I can tell.
That's right. That's what we're here for.
But the thing is that, you know, when you see these fucking parents who are doing this, you know, is your kid now 16 and saying they want to have the surgery? Well, here's something that's very serious that nobody brings up. This is the physical changing of a body. That means your child who's, you know, 16, 17 and still in the stages of physical development, you're going to put them through that now. It's dangerous.
Yeah.
It is, because they haven't fully developed yet.
Right.
You wait until that child becomes 21, so that way they're a full-fledged adult, not just legally, but a full-fledged physical adult, and then have them go do the surgery, but not when they're younger. For God's sakes, this is the problem with people in general. They don't think. And it's part of the – you know what? Whether the kids are trans, whether their kids are obsessed with you know, cultural appropriation, whether their kids are, you know, obsessed with, you know, going to bed, waking up and wearing a baseball uniform all the time. It doesn't matter. It's the same goddamn, my kid can do whatever they want, overindulgence thing.
Right.
It's part of a bigger problem. But no one ever wants to talk about it in a rational manner. And we're talking about it because it needs to be spoken of.
Right. And I would never wish on anybody the kind of societal shit that gets lumped on a kid who has those kinds of questions about sexual identity, sexual orientation, gender, all of those things, because those kids get the shit beaten out of them a lot. And it's not, I mean, it's not good and it's not right, but it just is. And I've seen and been close up with a lot of that back in my younger life, back when I was 14, 15, 16 years old. But I agree with you. I mean, I would feel the same way about that kind of surgical solution at that age as I would about these fucking pageant moms who go out and get their 14-year-old daughter a breast augmentation. What are you doing?
Well, what about those that tromp out their little kids? I mean, look at what we have created by shows like that. I don't even know the name of it. The pageant show that
Toddlers and Tiaras.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. With that spurned on the likes of Honey Boo Boo. For
right.
Fuck's sake.
Yep.
This is the society that seems to thrive on this right now. But let me tell you something, and I say this in absolute. I could not be more serious. You know, if anybody's got an understanding of what, you know, gay teenagers go through, I dealt with it when I was a teenager because everybody thought I was gay. And that includes everyone in my family. And having someone in my family telling my parents that and putting that notion in their heads is a really fucked up thing to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not being funny when I say it, even though it came out funny when I actually delivered the line, when I had this conversation with my parents. Well, we've never ever seen you bring home a girl. And my answer, when I looked at them with such incredulousness and said, have you ever met you or the family? If I ever wanted to have the chance of getting laid a second time by the same girl, I think maybe you would understand why. But it's the whole notion of understanding what they go through, because people think you are. People would think, right up to the years that I worked at Atlantic Records, before I got married, that I was gay. Why? Because I was well-dressed and well-spoken. That's the way people think.
Yeah.
If you well dressed and well spoken, you must be a homosexual of some sort or another. You know, I dated a girl who people thought was a lesbian because she had short hair. Really?
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because over the course of time, I mean, when I was 14 and a freshman in high school, or 13, I guess, one of my best friends was the gay kid. And I had no idea. I just had no, because I didn't give a shit. You know, that's not why we were best friends. We just hung out, you know, and went and played video games and shit. But, you know, I found out later from the guidance counselor all the stuff that he was going through. And I thought, oh, okay, that's interesting. But, you know, you look back now and it's like, well, it should have been obvious. But it just, again, it brings home, that's not where our heads were at the time.
Well, there you go. You've just nailed it in a nutshell, because if you're a reasonable person with a sense of focus and a broad scope, I hate the cliche, but if you're a big picture kind of person, it's not going to come into your head. It doesn't matter, you know? It does not matter if this one's gay or this one's Hispanic or this one's black or this is, you know, as long as you're not an asshole.
Right.
Because if you're an asshole, then I'll not want to have anything to do with you, and I will certainly look at you with a very raised questionable eyebrow of, why are you talking to me? We have nothing to discuss. We have nothing we're going to agree upon. Look, I'm not kidding. There was a point where I was dating someone who I very rarely would introduce the women I dated to my family, simply because, and I'm saying this in a non-comedic way, but they were an embarrassment. You know, they would, mm-hmm. they would just say such, for whatever reason, whenever I would bring someone around, let's put it that way. I don't know about the rest, but whenever I would bring someone, there was always some kind of comment that was always to be made, which I found to be just beyond my comprehension after a while. And I was dating this young woman who, you know, they asked me about her. I said, well, she's Orthodox Jewish. I didn't mention the fact that she was black, but she just happened to be Orthodox Jewish.
Uh-huh.
Did they give a shit that she was black, believe it or not? No, it was the fact they were all overjoyed that she was Orthodox Jewish. I'm not Orthodox. I don't go to temple. You know?
Right.
I wouldn't go with her to temple. I may lie to everybody and say, you know, I'm Shomer Shabbos. But come on.
Yeah.
You know, this is how people think. And this is the stupid shit that they say and they do. You know, I'm going to tell a very quick story, and I think it kind of explains the whole thing of where I'm at and why I am the way I am about certain things, because I want things to be very – even though things are supposed to be black and white, they're gray areas all the time. And that's what people have to understand. That's why you need to look at the entire scope.
Right.
I dated a woman for a very, very long time, and my whole family knew her. And a cousin of mine was having her bas mitzvah when she turned 13. And I had said to my aunt that we were going to be coming to the temple for this – by 2:30, whenever the thing was supposed to start. And she turns around and she says to me, well, she's not invited. And I said, excuse me? And she said to me, she's not invited. I said, do you want to explain to me before I really lose it why she's not invited? And she said, because she's not Jewish. And that's when I really lost it. I said, your husband isn't Jewish. Your father isn't Jewish. Your sister-in-law is not Jewish. Your other brother-in-law is not Jewish. My father is not Jewish. What the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah, the time.
Where did you come from? When did you suddenly get such religiosity? You know, people's hypocrisy will lose me faster than anything else. The minute I get a waft of it, you lose me completely. And when you trump out your kids and you use them to make your political statement because it's the flavor of the month, I have a problem with it, you know?
Yeah.
Your kids are your kids. You're supposed to be protecting them and taking care of them, not putting them in with this now media-engaged group of what becomes freaks. And I'm going to tell you what you and I talked about a couple of weeks ago is really coming home to roost in several of my gay friends. And I hate saying that, but they are gay, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah.
They started to – because, you know, what are you going to do, say, you know, friends who happen to be gay? That sounds like you're just clouding it. Many of my gay friends have already started to say what you and I called a couple of weeks ago, that community is starting to eat itself up from within, because now the trans community thinks they're the spokesman for everybody else, and they're thinking, that, hang on a second, you don't represent me in any way, shape, or form, and I do not like what you're doing, and how dare you lump yourselves in with us.
Right. And that's the thing. My wife and I were talking about this earlier today. And the fact is, whenever anybody with a cause comes out and starts carrying a sign and screaming at me, "This is who I am," my reaction is usually, okay. You know, it's like, okay, this is who you are. That's fine with me. I don't care. But yeah, it's when it goes the step beyond and forces me into a position where I have to take a position. It's like, I didn't care who you were. Like you said, as long as you're not an asshole, you're fine with me. But I didn't care until you decided to make it my issue.
Well, the thing is, you're also a lot nicer than I am, first of all. And I'm in New York, and New York, you are just going to be browbeaten to death by all of this horse shit, this fake liberal – keywords, fake liberalism. Mm-hmm. It's the in, it's the now. It's, we've seen it all before. We've heard it all before. It's just now it's the tranny community. No, sorry, I'm not going to say the tranny, because that's the trans community, versus the trannies are a completely different thing. They're an entertainment.
They're fun, yeah, right?
Hi, sailor. Hi, daddy. Yeah. That's a completely different kettle of fish. Sorry, and I apologize profusely. I want to make sure that the distinctions are clear.
Yeah,
you know, the trans community are this year's, you know, who are this year's Black Lives Matter. You know, it's every fucking cause, flavor, call it what you will, bullshit of the month.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it boils down to.
Yeah, we have a friend of the family who is trans and is post-op trans, and he is an activist, but one of the more relaxed ones that you'll find, and one of the more rational and sane ones that you'll find. It's like you still have to recognize, yes, society has its biases and its proclivities, and it has its things that it gets weirded out about for no good reason. And you have a couple of choices. You can talk to somebody about that, or you can scream at them about it. And this guy talks to them about it, and it's a lot easier to deal with that way. But you know, I hear you about New York and the fact that every time you turn around, somebody else is trying to make their issue your issue. And it's just, leave me alone. And that, I think that's what most of us want, is just leave me alone and I'll decide what I'm going to do. You decide what you're going to do and I won't give you any shit about it.
Right. You know, it's, we are forced more often than not to look at topics that, you know, I don't think by and large that you or I are uncomfortable with any of these people or any of the things that they're about as people. But it's when they come up with the, it's almost like you're watching them and suddenly there's a switch that's turned on and they suddenly become full of shit.
Yeah.
It's like, wait, where did the person I was just talking to disappear? Is it because there's an audience? Is that it? Is it for the sake of the onstage effect because there are others around you? Because as you well know, certainly in the world of the social media justice warriors, if you disagree on the slightest with any of them, they come on you like a bunch of rabid pack wolves, you know, like a bunch of vultures swooping in to pick the bones. There is this group that I've now taken myself out of called Remembering REM. It was just supposed to be a fun little group of, you know, people who dug REM and just, you know.
Yeah.
One guy put himself in a very uncomfortable position, and obviously he quickly took himself out. But I wound up taking myself out afterwards, saying, you know, basically that he was a conservative and a Republican, but he was also a friend of REM, and he was just wondering, you know, what people's takes on it would be, simply because, you know, it's always been kind of an open – REM always preached kind of an open community vibe, if you will,
yep,
for anybody. When I tell you they went on him like flies on shit, forget it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is the kind of not – but again, we're talking about social media, which is nonsense. This is also a group that keeps saying the same stupid things over and over again, like, oh, we should get back together. Do you ever listen to what the members of the band say? No, we're not going to get back together again. And that it's already now 6 years since their split, that you got to understand it was a band.
Yeah.
They didn't save the world. They made a shit ton of money, you know, that you and I will never see in our lifetimes. You know, how about you just leave them fuck alone and just remember the good music and dial it back a little bit? But again, you can't even admit that you're a Republican. Now, maybe the guy was, you know, doing it to see what kind of, you know, reaction he'd elicit. But the point is, the way that they turned on him was with that kind of pack rat viciousness.
Yeah.
And that's what the left, the far left, has come to with every single issue that has become in general, a question mark. They've made it something that it really shouldn't be. They've made the mountains out of the molehills. You know, the smartest thing that anyone can do if you're left-leaning, and that's the phrase I'll use, because this includes some really stupid Democrats and most of the liberals. Let the Republicans, who are in charge of everything right now, keep drowning, because that's what they're doing. You and I talked about it. Keep your mouths shut. Don't fan the flames. Don't keep going on about revolution and
stop acting indignant about all of it. There is nothing that will lose people faster than indignancy.
Right. And by the way, when they're finally going down for the last time in the quicksand, somebody please, notice I'm saying it like that, somebody please come up with a rational list of these are the problems and these are the ways that we can possibly fix them in a compromised manner. We're not politicians, John. Why is it we're able to see these things and come up with just reasonable blueprints?
I don't know, but I can tell you this. I mean, in my business, I have seen talk radio since the time that I got into this business turn into this hellscape, this pit of vomit. And I don't know exactly why it happened, but when I started, there was on every station, there was the liberal guy and there was the conservative guy. And then there was the funny guy or the middle of the road guy. And then there was the news guy. Everybody had their place in this. And now when you look across the country at what talk radio is, you have two choices. You have the Howard Stern, let's talk to lesbians about their breasts. And you have, you know, rabid right-wing conservatives. And that's it. Any kind of rationality, any kind of just conversation and just entertainment, for fuck's sake, just entertain people. That has gone so far out the window. And it's exactly what you were talking about with the REM group on the flip. Because if you say anything that is at all open-minded, they lose their shit on you.
What, dude? I got my grease gun. Bone dry.
There's still a few of us out there, but boy, you know, we're plugging away in a very small space. But you know what? As long as they keep putting me in front of a microphone and giving me a paycheck for it, I find it really hard to bitch.
They don't give me a paycheck, but all I have to say is baba booey. See, no. I wanted to bring up something because you were talking about it at the very outset of the show, you know, this being our anniversary show and, you know, doing something for 4 years that, you know, usually – listen, first of all, I don't date anybody, let alone stay married to them more than 4 years, you know, and I'm married almost 19 years to this one.
Attaboy.
But you and I have been doing this for 4 years, and I kind of liken us to being – you're Opie and I'm Anthony. I'm not in a bunker and I don't have a gun and I'm not screaming racial epithets out in 40 seconds.
Well, yeah.
That's about it. But I mean, that's, you know, ours is kind of like the thinking man's O&A, except we don't have, you know, a disgusting, immoral degenerate like Jim Norton as our third.
You know? Give it time. We'll find somebody. But in the meantime, that brings us quite nicely around to the In Our Head segment this week. And I want to go off into a little bit of a different direction with it because I mentioned to you before we got started to start thinking about breakup songs. And the reason is because you and I have talked a lot in the past about people that we admire that have shuffled off this mortal coil. And this week we lost one of them who gave us one of the great breakup songs of all time. Michael Johnson died at 72. And for anybody who ever went into a roller skating rink from 1979 to 1983, when it got to the couple skate, it's funny how many couple skate songs were breakup songs, but Bluer Than Blue.
Yep.
I really should be glad, but I'm bluer than blue. Sadder than sad. You're the only light this empty room has ever had. Life without you is gonna be bluer than blue.
It was everywhere, and you know,
had that because that was also the first single on the brand new EMI America label at that time.
Right.
That came out right around the time that I think right after Randy Van Warmer released Just When I Needed You Most.
Yes.
Another heart wrencher.
I miss you more than I missed you before, and now where I'll find comfort, God knows. Cause you
right.
Whatever. What is the proper vernacular, Professor? Is it heart-rending or heart-wrenching? Because you feel like your heart is being wrenched out with the emotion of the song. So I always figured that would be correct.
I think either one of them's fine. But yeah, I mean, that song, Bluer Than Blue, I mean, I remember it. That I think I was in fifth grade. So yeah, it would have been 1980. That's when I remember it really hitting hard, was during that summer. And, you know, as much as I was never that much into heartstringy kind of stuff, for some reason, that one just sort of worked. And I know Michael Johnson's done a whole bunch more than just that. He's a great singer, or was anyway, a great singer-songwriter, and had a number of minor and a couple of major hits to his credit. But still, Bluer Than Blue was the one that popped right into my head as being that kind of, the one that really captured that feeling of how shitty you feel in that first couple of days after a breakup went by, and you have time to think about all the things you're not going to do now, you know?
Well, I'm glad you brought this one up.
Do tell.
Well, one of them is a song that I mentioned earlier when we were talking about production from the 70s, The Last Song by the Edward Bear.
Yeah.
I mean, those, to this day, from the first time I heard the song, never mind the melody, which is just great and catchy, the words, it's the last song I'll ever write for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's the last time that I'll show you just how much I really care. I mean, God, the protagonist of this song with, you know, leaving the light on.
This is the last song I'll ever sing for you. You come looking for the light, and it won't be there, but I love you. Oh, yes, I do.
And, you know, but 2 years gone by and still my light's on. It's just, it's horrible.
Yeah.
It's really hard, but it says everything. Now, taken on a more personal level and a non-laughable side of things, you know, when I was going through a very, very unhappy period, there was one song in particular that actually was, I felt, a very pointed on the one kind of salve on that wound, and that was Out of Your Life by Bob Mould.
Yeah.
You know, which the lyrics to that are pretty, there's no room for misinterpretation, you know. If you want me out of your life, all you got to do is tell me.
Now if you want me.
It says everything right there.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, every line of that song makes you feel exactly what you're feeling at that moment. And hopefully instead of the pain that you're going through, because there is that momentary, it's a combination of momentary numbness and blankness at the same time, because you know that you're about, it's the moment before the dam bursts and all the emotions come on.
Right.
And this buildup is happening and you can feel it and you're trying to process, but you just can't yet, because if you do, you're going to start thinking about it. And then the thinking will turn into the physical illness when you feel nauseous and so on and so forth.
Right.
So that's another breakup song that definitely kicks you right in the head repeatedly. So too with that would be Bob Mould's old band Husker Du. Don't Want to Know If You're Lonely, and Sorry Somehow. Sorry Somehow, especially because of the way Grant Hart delivered the vocals, where he's actually literally screaming it, but he's screaming it in melody. You want me to tender an apology? It's not my fault, and you're not getting one from me.
Yeah, right.
End of story right there.
Yeah,
you know?
And I mean, you have it from the female perspective, too. You have two of the best breakup albums of all time, even though, I mean, it's not my bag that much, but, I mean, Adele's Rolling in the Deep and Alanis Morissette. So with Jagged Little Pill, you have both sides of the same thing, where Adele's is very melancholy and the music has that, you know, the strains of the violin and all of it. And Alanis was just, fuck you, get out of here. You know, I hate your guts now.
But that the beauty of what you just picked is that it's the two sides of the spectrum, because it's almost like the first one is the knee-jerk reaction, the Alanis Morissette record. And the Adele album is more the, okay, I've got some perspective on it, and it sucks, and this is what you did, and you're a real fucker.
Right.
With the male perspective, of course, of these, it runs the gamut of emotions from hot to cold. So, you know, you've got those Bob Mould, Husker Du type songs where you want to scream it out and try and get it out of your system. You know, and then you get a song like all right, I'll give you a couple of other really good breakup songs that definitely come to mind. You Tell Me Why, and what's the other one? It's by the Bo Brummels, along with Just a Little. I mean, those two songs just pull the heartstrings. It's like, okay, now I'm going through the pain section of this.
Well, let's not forget Player, shall we?
Because that was just too much mellow gold for my very delicate constitution. We're filled with breakup songs. I mean, that's, you know, the 70s were rife with that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are breakups, or for that matter, Greg Kinn's Immortal, the breakup song.
I was just going to bring that one up. I'm so glad you did.
How could we not pick that one as the number one? Because it's the obvious, but it's not that obvious because it's, you know, yeah, they don't write them like that anymore.
Right.
But still, Greg Kinn always did it with a tongue-in-cheek kind of approach.
Yeah. Well, in that one, it's another one of those great songs where the music doesn't match the emotion of the lyrics, because it is the breakup song. And, you know, it was that same old song with a melancholy sound. That song doesn't have a melancholy sound. It sounds almost noir.
Is, you know, I was thinking when you said breakup songs, my immediate mental picture was Stan lying on his bed after Wendy dumped him, and then Air Supply's All Out of Love playing. And then poor Butters sitting in the rain and crying after he's dumped by the girl from Raisins.
Right.
And by the way, Butters is my favorite character on South Park anyway. But I mean, you know, what Butters says at the end about, no, I'm actually happy because I can feel something.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not always going to feel this way, but I'm happy that I can feel this kind of pain right now. And he called it a sweet kind of sadness. And he goes, and I'd rather be a crying little pussy than a bunch of faggy goth kids. I mean, he did it so perfectly. And that's when Stan went home, and after, you know, washing off the goth look, went back to the rest of his friends, you know, and very wisely said, hey, Wendy, you're a bitch, and hey, Token, right here, buddy, and he flips him the bird. I mean, that's the way you recover from a breakup. You go through the pain. I'll be serious for a second. When you go through a breakup, you go through the pain elements. It is a form of loss. So you go through the pain and the anger and the confusion as to why and how this happened. If you're not certain, if it's kind of murky, there's going to be confusion, and that's usually how it plays out. When you recover with something of a vengeance. And I don't mean you hunt down your ex and hurt them. I'm talking about if they do that thing that so many tend to do, and they call you and they're emailing you, and you left me, remember?
Yeah, right.
You left me, so leave me the fuck alone.
Yeah.
Helpful hint to anyone listening to this. If somebody leaves you, but then they keep calling you and emailing you, the way to make them completely insane while actually helping yourself therapeutically is to completely ignore them, even though you're tempted. Let the phone ring. Let them leave the voicemail. Let them leave an email. Just delete it.
Yeah. Well,
respond and don't give them any kind of feeling like they have any kind of sway over you.
And then you can always follow that up with Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks doing, "How Can I Miss You When You Won't Go Away?"
Or that immortal song that I actually found myself writing that I still have yet to commit to vinyl, but everybody who's heard it really loves it. Don't Worry, Baby, I'm Not Your Victim. I think that says it all right there. Yeah. You know, because, you know, and I'm not tooting my own horn, but that song really was just basically a checklist of everything that had transpired. And the person who, the antagonist of this story, not protag, but antagonist of this story, thought she's the kind of person that likes to have, or thinks she likes to have, thinks that she has a hold over whomever she hurts. I mean, that's just her pattern, mm-hmm. as I learned the hard way. Okay, so be it. But, you know, I really didn't give her any credence simply because I wouldn't answer the phone. I wouldn't respond to her emails, texts, voicemails, nothing. And I want to add that she continued to do so for 2 years after we'd split. I kid you not, you know. And it just, it didn't, at a point, it doesn't matter, you know, because the beauty of all of this is you get to that moment and it's an aha moment when you realize, A, you're not thinking about them that much, and B, you're so tired of the sound of your own voice and the sound of these love songs where you've now broken up. You just don't want to hear them again because now it's tired.
Right.
You're bored with it and you're purged from it, you know?
It is a great feeling. Well, and this is always a good feeling talking to you, Rob Ross, every week. Thank you so much. And we will get back together and do some more Radio City with you next time around.
Yes, we will. And for all those listening, please do continue to listen. And more importantly, check out Pop Dose.
Do that.
There's so many good things on there now and coming up. And it's just a really great and exciting time, and Radio City is part of that.
Yeah, very proud of that too. So yeah, do check it out. There's all kinds of information out there for you elsewhere on the website. Do that. Leave us some comments in the comment section, and we'll talk to you next week.